Yeah, he's a good guy. All right. Good morning. It is 10 a.m., September 29th, 2009. This is the North Dakota Public Service Commission meeting at its irregularly scheduled meeting, because usually we meet on Wednesdays. But must be a big week going on or something. Some folks are going to be gone. So we're meeting on Tuesday this week. This is Kevin Kramer along with Tony Clark and Brian Kalk for the commission meeting. Good morning and welcome to everyone. Any opening comments by my colleagues?
Good morning and welcome.
Thanks for coming.
All right. We'll go right into the regular...
Move the items on consent.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Now to the regular agenda. Beginning with KC1. I move the commission close out contract number AM580-09 with Kern and Tabery Inc. for completion of reclamation work at the Hazen West Phase 2 Abandoned Mine Lands Reclamation Project.
Second.
This contract required the company to reclaim about 50 acres of abandoned high walls and pits in the Beulah Mine Wildlife Management Area. The work is done for a total cost of just under $600,000.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. KC2. I move the commission issue an intent to award a contract to Basaraba Excavating and Dirtworks, LLC, in the amount of $91,275 for the 2009 maintenance sinkhole filling AML project that involves filling sinkholes at several abandoned underground coal mine sites in western North Dakota.
Second.
This was a bid opening that where we received five bids in response to the solicitation. Bids were opened on Friday of last week. Low bid came from Basaraba of Wilton in the amount of $91,275. The other bids ranged from $121,050 to $162,110. The staff estimated about $139,750. So this was quite a bit lower than the other bids and lower than the estimate. The primary purpose of the project is to fill underground coal mine sinkholes near Noonan, Dickinson, Wilton, and Beulah Zap, as well as a contingency item for other dangerous sinkholes that are reported at other sites up to the ending date of the contract, which is June 30th of next year.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And KC3, I move the commission issue a notice of opportunity for hearing in the application of Montana Dakota Utilities Company, a division of MDU Resources Group, Inc., for a certificate of public convenience and necessity to expand the service area of the U.S. Bioenergy Natural Gas Transport Line, case number PU09649.
Second.
This is a request for an amendment to an existing PCNN of the, you might recall, the 16-mile line off of the Alliance Pipeline tap near Fairmont that was put in place by MDU to serve the bioenergy facility near Hankinson. And we did issue that PCNN in 2007. Since that time, there's been one other small tap late last year that went to a grain handling facility. This new PCNN expands the area around that 16-mile line that will allow more taps into more potential customers and facilities in that area. It's about 181 square miles of area surrounding the existing distribution line. The expanded area would allow these taps into the 16-mile line, but there's already two grain facilities and a flour mill that have expressed an interest in extending the existing distribution facilities in order to contract for natural gas transportation. Those are near Fairmont. The two grain facilities were interested in moving ahead quite quickly with hopes of getting natural gas yet this fall. I don't know that we can get it done quite that quickly or not, but at any rate, it is encouraging, first of all, to see the original investment being expanded and seeing the opportunity for some value added to that original 16-mile line, and to see more use for that natural gas. And, of course, the Alliance Pipeline, seeing some more of that capacity being utilized as well. So members of the public and others will have until November 13th of this year to file a request for a hearing. If none are filed, then we could take it up either in an informal hearing or make the decision without a hearing.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio, Commissioner Clark.
Thank you. Item TC1, I move the commission deem the applications complete, conditioned on a filing of final transmission line structure locations on or before October 20th, 2009, and issue a notice of filing and notice of hearing in the applications of Basin Electric Power Cooperative for a waiver of procedures and time schedules, a corridor certificate, and a route permit for its proposed Williston to Tioga 230 kV electric transmission line in Williams and Montreal counties of North Dakota, case number PU07671. By this order, we'll be setting up a public hearing, which we have scheduled for October 27th, 2009, starting at 10:30 a.m. Central Daylight Time at the City Commission Room in Williston. It is to have a formal hearing on a proposed transmission line, which will run from the Williston substation to the Tioga substation, and it basically follows the well-trod path that many of us know on Highway 2 between Tioga and Williston. In fact, parallels the road fairly closely for most of it. This is a project that has been in the works for some time, and I know has generated some interest in that part of the country. It's our understanding it's primarily for so much of the oil and gas development that is going on in that part of the state, and is much like our Rame to Belfield line, indicative of the amount of new load that's coming online in the western part of the state. So we'll look forward to that hearing again October 27th. We have set the deadline for the line structure locations for October 20th so that the public as well as the commission has a full week to review those prior to the hearing.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC2, I move the commission deem the application for certificate of site compatibility complete, conditioned on the filing of final turbine locations on or before October 29th, 2009, and issue a notice of filing and notice of hearing in case number PU08797, Sequoia Energy U.S. Inc.'s proposed 150-megawatt wind conversion facility, Rolette County, North Dakota.
Second.
We're by this motion scheduling a public hearing for November 3rd at 10:30 a.m. Central Time at the City Commission Hearing Room in Rolla. The proposed wind farm that Sequoia Energy has filed an application for is located just about due north of Rolla, in between Rolla and the U.S.-Manitoba or the U.S.-Canadian border, and just to the east of St. John. Basically, North Dakota 30 runs through it, and it's directly north of 281. So when they say border wind project, it's literally on the border. Again, November 3rd is our date for that, and we plan to have final turbine locations on file by October 29th, again, so the public and the commission can review those prior to our hearing.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC3. I move the commission file an application with the Richland County District Court, Southeast Judicial District, for appointment as trustee of Verisun Hankinson LLC, Hankinson, North Dakota, under North Dakota Century Code Chapter 6002, in Public Service Commission case number GE09104.
Second.
As you all know, Hankinson is a 1.1 million bushel ethanol facility. It's been licensed as a public grain house for some time. The facility under our current bond schedule has a $380,000 bond on file. In October of last year, Verisun filed for bankruptcy with the U.S. Bankruptcy Court in Delaware. In March of this year, we received a claim for nonpayment from a producer in the amount of almost $106,000, and subsequent to that, in August, we received a second claim for almost $27,000. Because it's in U.S. bankruptcy court, all proceedings against or in dealing with Verisun are halted, and the U.S. bankruptcy court really makes the calls from there. At the end of March of this year, the commission filed a motion for relief from stay with the bankruptcy court, and there were a series of hearings that were scheduled and subsequently rescheduled. In August of this year, Liberty Mutual Insurance Company, which is the bonding company, filed an opposition to our relief from stay, and as you recall from a meeting or two ago, the commission entered into a stipulation with affected debtors in Liberty Mutual, which will allow the commission to move forward on parts of this insolvency, but not the entire thing. The U.S. bankruptcy judge signed that in Delaware September 14th of this month. What we are allowed to move forward with, and what this motion will allow us to move forward with, is first to allow the commission to formally secure its appointment as trustee under state law. Once we do that, we'll be able to publish in the newspapers of record and start so that producers, if there are additional claims out there, can come forward. That'll enable the commission, once we receive those claims, to evaluate them, and we'll be able to prepare a draft report, but not a final report, and not a report that we can file with state court. That can only come after we gain final release from the U.S. bankruptcy proceeding. So this will kick off the process and allow us to become appointed trustee, at least in a limited manner, and allow us to begin preparing that report.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC 4, I move the commission file the report and recommendation of trustee with district court recommending that the bond proceeds in this case be used to pay claimants based on their valid cash sale claims. I further move that once court approval is obtained, payments be forwarded to these claimants as soon as possible in Sustainable Systems LLC, DBA Montola Roving Grain Buyer Insolvency, case number GE09112.
Second.
This was one of the more unique, I guess I'd say, cases that the commission has dealt with on the licensing side, in that Sustainable Systems is based and has a facility in Montana, but was licensed as a roving grain buyer in North Dakota. The bond that's on file in North Dakota is just $130,000, which would not be nearly enough to cover all the valid claims that we had in North Dakota, which totaled almost $562,000. Fortunately, in this case, because you had two states dealing with it, Montana was able to use its licensing authority and gain quite a bit of assets that would be available to be dispersed to valid claimants, and those were dispersed regardless of whether they were in Montana and North Dakota. And because of that, they had some flexibility that we otherwise, frankly, under our state law, wouldn't have. They have ability to leverage more assets, actually, under their state law. So what happened was even North Dakota claimants over this interim period have been receiving payments from the Montana Department of Agriculture under their state law, and then what was ever remaining is going to be paid out under the bond that's available here in North Dakota. Of course, we don't have any assets available as a roving grain buyer. In May of this year, the district court appointed the commission trustee. As I said, there were 18 valid claims that totaled $561,629.40. The Montana Department of Agriculture was able to distribute proceeds that allowed each North Dakota claimant to receive 77% of his or her claim, and the commission is now able, with the remaining money that we have, which comes to just about $130,000 exactly, which is our bond, to pay the remaining 23% of the valid claims. And then if there's any money left over, a proportionate share of interest as the funds permit. So in this case, it appears that valid claimants will receive 100% of the money that's due them. That doesn't always happen, but we're always pleased when it's able to. And I'd like to thank the work of our licensing division, Sue, as well as our legal staff. This was a little more complex than most cases because you're dealing with different jurisdictions and it was handled in a unique manner, but I know the commission appreciates and producers as well their hard work.
It's also one of the more pleasurable ones because when the ending result is everybody gets made whole, the work looks a little bit lightened. But I've never had so many expressions of appreciation from producers as we have in this case. They knew what you guys were up against and appreciated it very much.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. TC5, I move the commission adopt the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issuing certificate of site compatibility number 15 to Minnesota Power and operating division of Elite, Inc., authorizing construction of its proposed 75.9 megawatt Bison Wind Project in Oliver and Morton counties of North Dakota, case number PU09151.
Second.
The commission held a hearing in New Salem on the 25th of August, and I suppose perhaps one of the more remarkable things about this one was it was fairly unremarkable in this terms of turnout from the general public. We did have some folks who showed up, but in relation to some of the other recent public hearings that we've had, there was proportionally quite a few less folks that came out, which I think probably spoke to the fact that Minnesota Power had a fairly tight and well put together application, which seemed to clear any hurdles that might have been there prior to the hearing itself. The application was fairly straightforward. As you know, this is to the north and a bit west of New Salem. It's 75.9 megawatts. As far as issues that we dealt with in it, of course, any wind farm in this area, we end up talking about whooping cranes these days because of the activity of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the area, as well as wind developers. Minnesota Power is, as other companies are, participating in the Habitat Conservation Plan, which hopefully should give them some liability protection at some point down the line if there were an unfortunate taking of an endangered species. As far as other unique aspects of this, one of the questions that the commission did ask is to provide any information regarding whether there are known coal reserves in this particular area. This, of course, generally speaking, is coal country, but there are areas of lesser and greater coal deposits, and Minnesota Power did submit a map which indicates that they don't believe there are known coal deposits there, and part of the commission's interest in this, of course, comes out of the last legislative session when we're charged with looking at the orderly development of energy where there may be multiple energy sources available. There was some discussion about road locations. Morton County requires certain setbacks. In one case, the setback that they required was a little bit closer than we've traditionally put wind turbines. Usually, we've tried to have a 1.1 setback from rights of way for roads. There was one case where there was a very rural country road, not highly traveled, where Morton County permitted it to be a little bit closer than that, not closer than 300 feet, but within the 1.1. And the commission discussed this a bit in our work session and felt that we were comfortable allowing local officials some discretion on particular issues like that, where they know probably the country roads a bit better than we do. And finally, with regard to impact on residences in the area, there are no wind turbines within 1,500 feet at all, and a much greater distance to any non-participating landowner. I don't recall the exact foot distance, but it seems to me that it was well over half a mile, something like 3,000 feet. We can find that if you're interested in it. But in any case, there was no opposition from any landowners participating or not. Looks to be in order. Recommend approval.
All in favor?
Aye.
That ends the items in my portfolio.
Commissioner Kolk.
Good morning. Item BK1, I move the commission adopt the order on EISA standards, which is Energy Independence and Security Act, in case number PU0920, Public Service Commission, Federal 2007 EISA Standards Investigation.
Second.
Basically, the Federal Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007 was enacted in December of 2007, required each state to consider adopting certain specified energy policy standards. Examples of those standards are new electric policy standards regarding integrated resource planning, rate design and modifications to promote energy efficiency and investments, consideration of smart grid investments, and also smart grid information. Also, there was some items on natural gas policy standards, also regarding energy efficiency and rate design to promote energy efficiency investments. And finally, it asks us to consider waste heat recovery offering incentives to owners and operators. Over the last year, there has been a variety of workshops, hearings, and we asked for comments from the public. We received comments from all the investor-owned utilities and numerous groups as about how, you know, how we should move forward on this. But the bottom line, the commission order states that no further action will be taken to adopt the federal standards. However, the commission will consider all such appropriate energy efficiency measures on a utility-by-utility basis and a case-by-case basis.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Item number BK2. I move the commission adopt the order certifying use of the federal universal service support for rural eligible telecommunication carriers to receive federal universal service funding in 2010, case number PU09217.
Second.
The Telecommunication Act of 1996 requires carriers to use the universal service support only for the provision, maintenance, and upgrading of facilities and services for which support is intended. It's basically a formula based on the number of lines and the cost per line. Each state is required to file an annual certificate with the FCC to ensure each rural telecom carrier receiving federal funds is using them the manner which intended. We have received affidavits from the companies listed on page 2 and 3 of the order, stating that they are using the funds as required. Basically, there's 45 different companies from Absaraka to Overton. And once this is, if approved, we will send a copy of the affidavits to the FCC and meet the requirement of the law.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
That concludes the items in my portfolio.
Okay. Is there anything else for the good of the order before we, any announcements? Looking at our formal hearing docket, we do have a hearing scheduled for October 6th on the NuStar pipeline project, the PCNN. It's been hanging around for quite a while as interveners and the company have been negotiating, I suspect. With that, are there any questions?
I was looking at the consent agenda.
Basically, Dale, that's just a request that that the local investor-owned utility provide electricity to the site vice the co-op. We have nothing to do with the oil or the salt water, just a power extension.
Okay. How about the CBK7, the numbering issues investigation?
Sure. We have jurisdiction over different numbering blocks, and this is opening up a new numbering block in the Fargo area of 446. We've done that previously in different parts of the state.
Okay, who asked for this investigation for the number of factors?
I don't.
Any particular entity?
I got to ask Pat here real quick.
I think it was bandwidth.com was the name of the company, and it's just a matter of if we get a request from the numbering administrator to certify that that's been opened, then we check into it and send it along. Otherwise, you know, they have a set of standards that will close a certain block.
Yep, that's exactly bandwidth.com.
Okay, U.S. Bioenergy is the Verisign. Right?
That's correct.
KC3, what area are we talking about that this would affect?
Actually, I have a color map for you if you'd like to have it. But it's there's a 16-mile distribution line that comes from a tap off of the Alliance line near Fairmont, then runs toward Hankinson, toward the Verisign facility. Basically, what this does is it creates an area on both sides. It's like almost like if we're siting a pipeline and you have the route permit and then you have what's the word I'm trying to think of here? Service territory, basically. That's exactly right. And what it does is a PCNN, it's 181 square miles, so that going forward any taps onto that 16-mile distribution line, they wouldn't have to come and get PCNN every time they put a tap in, but rather that whole area would be MDUs. It's not unlike an electric PCNN. If we get, a MDU coming to us and asking for a PCNN to serve a certain rural area, and then we would allow a temporary permit, sign a temporary PCNN, And then if there's an objection by the local co-op or something, then we would hear a case, a territorial case. And this, you know, not likely to be competition for the gas business. But so it's much like what we're used to on the electric side, but it's very uncommon for us, at least in recent years, on the gas side.
Would an electric provider be eligible to ask for a hearing on the grounds that, you know, they may not be a gas supplier, but they could provide electricity, which also would provide the energy?
Well, you know what I was thinking? I don't know, Dale, that would seem, I mean, it's possible, but it would seem unlikely to me. What I think would be, what I suspect, for example, take these two grain facilities and the flour mill. I imagine that they have propane right now, and that this natural gas would be replacing propane. So whether these two grain facilities, which I believe are just their farmer-owned large grain handling storage facilities, they're probably drying grain with propane, and now they want to, you know, they want to get some lower-cost firm natural gas. Obviously, all of this infrastructure development is paid 100% by a customer that would be requesting it. I think that's an important little sideline fact. But it does add value, of course, to the existing 16-mile investment that's been made by MDU.
But just so that I'm clear, this would allow MDU to create taps for customers that want this gas from the line in this region that you're designating.
That's right, in this particular bordered region that we're talking about, again, at their cost.
Have you done this before?
I cannot think, frankly. I was thinking about, I'm sure we have, but I can't think of a time since I've been on the commission that we've done this. You might remember, and maybe you don't, but this particular line, we used to have a policy. This created a policy change. We used to have a policy that would, what we interpreted law to require us to even site this 16 miles because we considered it an intrastate transmission facility, I guess, as opposed to, say, a distribution facility. We changed that. We changed that policy because it was unclear even to us, and now deal with these issues on a case-by-case basis. From a siting standpoint, now from a PCNN standpoint, it's very clear that it requires a PCNN.
How long is there an opportunity for a hearing?
Till November, what did I say, November 13th, did I say? Let me just look real quick. I've got it right here in the order. November 13th, 2009, they have opportunity to request a hearing.
And can you just describe the customers that they have that are interested in this?
Well, the customers so far that have expressed an interest at this point are two grain handling facilities and a flour mill. So it's, you know, in my mind, again, I haven't talked to anybody specifically about this, but the most likely customer would be somebody who's probably using propane currently to either heat or to dry grain, or it's part of their process, as is the case with Verisun. But the one thing that I'd say that's an additional thing that's encouraging about this, you know, for years, maybe even a couple of decades, there's been a lot of talk about the lack of access to natural gas, especially firm natural gas, in the Red River Valley, in the eastern part of our state, for things such as industrial growth and value-added agriculture processing. And that lack of natural gas and firm transmission or transportation of natural gas, much like water, has been a deterrent to investment. Now we're seeing some more of that taking place. There's tremendous capacity, I think, on the Alliance pipeline yet for more gas. We're seeing more of our domestic gas companies express an interest in making some investments in gathering facilities and quasi-processing facilities to get gas at a point where it can now be transported on these large transmission lines. So this is just, in my mind, a small example of the potential and opportunity that exists for the growing supply as well as the transmission opportunities. This little 16-mile line suddenly opens up a lot of opportunity and possibilities for value-added agriculture and industrial growth.
Would this be practical, say, if a large farm operation wanted to purchase natural gas?
I think it is very possible, if not likely, that could be the case. If a farmer, for example, and again, this is just speculation on my part, but if a farmer was close enough to that 16-mile line and, you know, for a mile or two, for example, they could put in a small plastic line that wasn't overly expensive. If they're going to do it anyway to dry their grain, perhaps it does become competition with electricity, for example, for heating. I think it's more likely competition for propane. But, the other issue is MDU has a transport rate. I think it's rate 81 or maybe a couple of rates that they use for situations like this. This is only for the transporting of the gas. It's still up to the customer to negotiate a contract for gas with a firm or a non-firm supplier.
I mean, is this gas that can just be used?
Sure, it's fully processed gas. That's yes, could be used for home heating or grain drying or industrial use.
If I could just throw a thought out there, and this is just my own speculation, but somewhere in this discussion is the uncertainty the cap and trade is creating on electricity prices. Natural gas looks pretty good right now for the certainty of what the rules are going to be down the road. I think somewhere in the back of these folks that are going to be using a lot of energy, they're looking towards natural gas because they know what the rules and the pricing is going to be down the road. That's just my personal thoughts, but somewhere in there I think that's included.
That may be, but I would say this, that there's been no form of energy that's been less certain in terms of its price than natural gas in recent years.
The TC1, the Basin Electric line, mm-hmm. Could you just describe what that is, why that's being built, what it's for?
Sure. It's a 230 kV line that is being proposed. It's from Williston to Tioga. And we'll learn more at the hearing, but our understanding from the application and from just knowing what's going on in the energy business right now is that that's a line that substantially is going to beef up the transmission in that part of the state, primarily related to oil and gas development in the northwest part of the state. That, of course, is the center of the Bakken Formation and center of the region that has seen a lot of investment into oil and gas wells. Those oil and gas wells are very energy dependent. They use a lot of power, and so to beef up the transmission in that part of the state, Basin Electric is proposing this line from Williston to Tioga, and it should boost the reliability and the ability to deliver power to those new load centers that are opening up all across the northwestern part of the state.
It is interesting that for rural electric cooperatives in western North Dakota that have not seen a lot of load growth for decades, suddenly we're seeing quite a bit of it. The thing that's fun, it's fun to be in North Dakota, I guess, when you consider that we mine the coal that we burn to create the electricity that we send to the oil field to recover the oil that gets piped to the refinery that gets turned into gas and diesel that goes into the trucks that go to the coal mines. It's just great to have the solution to all of America's problems.
Hip bones connected. I was curious about on TC1 and TC2. There's a week of time for folks to examine where the electric line towers are and where the wind turbines are placed.
Right.
Is that enough time? Do you believe for people to look at that?
I think it is. I mean, it's one of the issues that the commission identified. Well, within the last few years, I mean, it had been a long time since we had done siting cases up till the last, or at least mass quantities of siting cases up until the last, 5 years. And one of the things that I think the commission became quickly frustrated with as we started going through that first batch of orders was that we didn't get actual locations of where towers or the actual location of the line, the towers for lines or wind towers themselves were going to be until the day of the hearing, and even at the date of the hearing, they were somewhat tentative. So one of the things that we have done in our more recent orders is really demand that energy developers have those final tower locations in at least a week prior so that the commissioners themselves can take a look at them. If there are interested landowners in the area, typically they're very engaged in the process, and so they would have that ability as well. But really the key is that those final tower locations are at the hearing on a map. Oftentimes that's people where get their information as they come in and they're able to look at it prior to the hearing itself. But certainly for the more engaged landowners, I mean, they're going to know about this and we'll be able to provide them those copies then in advance.
One of the reasons I asked is that, as you know, that was a major complaint of the Barnes County folks is yes. That, well, we didn't know where these turbines were going to be until the last minute. I mean, do you think that a week's time is sufficient to mollify those concerns?
Well, I think it is to the extent that the commission is really in charge of the process. And if we get the sense at the hearing from folks who feel that, you know, that even the week time wasn't enough time to really preview it and get a sense for what their response might be, we can then take that into account and you know, demand that there be more information put onto the record. You'll recall, as plans have changed in the past in some of our siting cases, for example, the Empower cases, the commission was then able to schedule extra hearings, if need be, go back to the local community and get more input. So we have some flexibility in these matters. Really, the one-week time period is kind of that initial step so that we know that when we get to the hearing itself, we have final plans. And if when we get to the hearing, we feel like we need a little bit more time and people in the community feel like they need a little bit more time, then we've got the flexibility to deal with.
You know, Dale, and I think your illustration or your example of the Barnes County situation is one where people that did not like the final locations of wind turbines felt like they didn't have enough time to protest it. They were then given extra time to protest it and didn't like the locations any better. So in many respects, there are lots of reasons people express for their protests, but at the end, tough decisions have to be made, and not everybody will like them.
The Sequoia Energy Project, are there any turbines in Canada that are part of this project?
I don't know. Jerry's shaking his head no. So it's our understanding that it's contained solely within the U.S.
How many turbines are there? Do you remember?
There are proposed to be 66 wind turbines totaling 150 megawatts total power.
Okay. And the hearing is going to be when?
It's November 3rd, 10:30, in Rolla at the City Commission hearing room.
Okay. The Virasun insolvency, could you just give me a sense of how this will speed up the resolution of this case once the bankruptcy is resolved?
Sure. Basically, the reason that it speeds it up is a good deal of the time delay that can take place in an insolvency proceeding is related to the notice requirements that the commission has under state law, advertising in newspapers. Oftentimes, depending on the newspaper, it can take several weeks to get placed and then have your run and then have an adequate amount of time for people to get back to us. So there are just certain statutory hurdles that create time delay that the commission has to deal with. By getting the limited relief from the bankruptcy proceeding, what it allows us to do is to get that publication done, hear from any producers who may need to be heard from, meet all of our statutory guidelines, get a draft report done. And then once we get a final release from this, then we can really go to the court very quickly, and depending on the court schedule, then hopefully get a trustee's report approved and disbursements made as quickly as possible.
Do you anticipate any added claims besides the ones you have?
We don't anticipate any. I mean, you can never say never, but in our discussions with Verisun and just what we've heard so far and the publicity that's been generated so far because of it, this is all that we know about and anticipate, but you never know.
It'd be hard to imagine that somebody's been away so long they didn't know what's going on, but it's nothing's.
Well, I get one of the reasons I asked is, as I recall, one of the claimants was carrying around a check for a long time and
substantial amount. The first claim, yeah, I mean, you know, bankruptcy was declared in October, and the first claim that we received wasn't until March of this year. And so there was a pretty fair time delay between the bankruptcy and the filing of a claim with us. And then after that, then it was another number of months. In August, we received a second claim. And I think for a while we weren't expecting any second claims. So even then, that came as a bit of a surprise. So that's why I say there's, you know, it's possible that there's some other folks out there, but we don't anticipate it.
The Bison 1 project, could you refresh my memory, please? What's the number of turbines in megawatts?
The number
75.9 megawatts.
Right? Yeah, 75.9 megawatts. The number of turbines is 33.
The sustainable systems case, I'm... just so that I'm clear, North Dakota claimants received proceeds from the liquidation of a grain elevator in Montana?
That is correct.
Would that be true if there were Montana claimants seeking proceeds from the liquidations of a elevator in North Dakota?
I don't believe so, and I see Alana...
Well, first of all,
if it was a Montana
producer that had sold to a North Dakota facility and had delivered grain to North Dakota, then yes, it would cover folks from other states. We don't make distinctions based on where the farmer resides. If they're a valid claimant, they're a valid claimant. Here, the reason I think our initial reaction was no is this is a little bit different in that we're talking about roving grain buyers, you know, the folks who dealt with a roving grain buyer here, but North Dakotans were able to benefit from Montana's law, which and negotiations that took place between North Dakota and Montana and the owner of it that allowed this to happen.
I wasn't precise enough, I'm sorry, but okay, were there situations where this company purchased grain in North Dakota as a roving grain buyer, it was delivered to Montana, and that claimant was paid because of the liquidation of the elevator, even though the claimant did not deliver the grain
yes,
to Montana?
Yes, 77% of what they've received is just that situation.
And would North Dakota law allow for that if you had a situation where a roving grain buyer bought grain in Montana, the Montana grain was never delivered by the farmer to North Dakota, but nonetheless, the North Dakota claimant could benefit from the bond in Montana. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of shooting from the hip here, but we haven't had that situation, to my knowledge, before in North Dakota. I think it's likely, and so, you know, the answer is who knows, but I think it's likely that under North Dakota law, valid claimants to a facility, because it would be licensed as a facility here in North Dakota, would be limited to claimants as our law defines it, which I think is those who deal specifically with the facility and not, you know,
but
those that were acting in a roving, but, you know, as a roving grain buyer. But I don't know if they're sending out...
Do we know how
many trucks to just deliver it back to the facility? That's a good question.
Do we know how many claims there were from North Dakota claimants?
Yes, there were...
I want to say like a dozen to few.
There were 18.
18 North Dakota claimants.
18 North Dakota claimants.
Do you know how much they were looking for?
Yeah, 561.
Oh, so that's... The 18 valid claims refers to the North Dakota claim.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. Dale, I want to make sure, your question, though, because I heard two things, I think. You were referring to liquidated assets and the bond, or because I...
Both, yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just...
I mean, one of the differences with North Dakota law, and it's one of the things that we've talked about with producers and the elevator industry as part of our discussions about protections for producers, is that the Montana law... apparently grants them far greater assets to the or far greater access to the assets of the elevator than North Dakota law does. Remember that North Dakota law restricts the trustee to physical grain assets, and in Montana they have access apparently not only to physical grain assets but also to some of the processed assets of the elevator, which has become an issue in some insolvencies in North Dakota, for example. The Northwood Mills case, where there were substantial assets available through the crushed oil, the crushed seed oil, and in that case, the bank, because of a priority lien, had access to that as opposed to us as trustee. Apparently, in Montana, that's not the case, which opened up far greater assets available in this, and North Dakota producers benefited because of it.
The Department of Agriculture in Montana actually was able to go secure bottles of safflower oil and I guess sunflower oil too as part of the liquidation process. So that's very unique.
In North Dakota, that would go to the bank.
Yeah. Or whoever had first lien.
Right, or whoever had first lien. And
the claimants, the North Dakota claimants, what did they sell to the elevator? Was it
safflower?
Safflower?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And part of the deal here is that the Montana law allows or gives the Montana Agriculture Department dibs on oil as well as safflower.
Yeah, whatever the process.
On greater assets. And they were able, they and our commission as well, were able to work with the owner of the plant facility as well to facilitate some of this.
You know what the total amount was that they were able to get out of the elevator, both the product and the bond?
Yeah, and I don't remember, Sudhi. About $1.2 million, so almost half of it.
So good deal. I mean, a good share of this was North Dakota.
Yeah. The other thing, Dale, I think that's interesting about this isn't just safflower. This is a very specific breed of safflower that met the standards for processing at this facility. So you really were putting producers in a bit of a bind when you give them a very specific standard breed to grow and then and then aren't able to buy it. So it was a unique situation all the way around.
The hearing that's referred to in the sheet of paper that I have of October 29th, where is that hearing? Do you know?
Is this the Williston hearing? Or
the sustainable, sustainable systems.
District Court in Bismarck. Yeah.
Okay.
The district court is scheduled a hearing October 29th, 11:30.
And this is October 29th, 11:30.
October 29th, 11:30 here at the Burley County Courthouse.
Okay. And this is to do what?
This is to schedule a hearing on the state district court signing off on the final trustees report. If they do, and assuming there are no challenges to it, then we can, as soon as we get the sign off from the judge, send out the checks.
So you have a plan to divvy up the $130,000?
Yes. The motion that's attached actually does have the proposed disbursement.
And this will be able to satisfy everyone, make everyone whole.
That is correct.
Okay, and this is the bond only on the roving grain buyer business of this company.
That is correct.
Do you know where the company is based, Sustainable Systems LLC?
Culbertson, Montana.
Okay, so it is Culbertson. All right. I was looking before the meeting through the EISA standards order.
God bless you.
Commissioner Cog mentioned this, but it basically says, well, we're not going to do anything. Could you just talk about why that is a prudent outcome here?
I don't believe that our order says we're not going to do anything. I believe our order says that we're going to do it utility by utility, case by case, and we already feel that we're doing a lot of the things that they're recommending we look at through our rate cases. I mean, the commission just finished a rate case with Xcel prior to the first of the year. We're in the final stages of one with Otter Tail right now. When companies come in with ways they want to do investments, we look at them. I don't think we're saying we're not doing this. I think what we're saying is that in our jurisdiction as North Dakota Public Service Commissioners, we're doing what's right for our state, and a federal standard would not fit for what we do in North Dakota for our diverse utilities. I mean, that's my opinion.
That's very well said, and I think we have recent history that illustrates pretty effectively that we pay attention to the very things that the EISA standards are talking about, things like resource planning and the role of demand side management and efficiency programs in that, and requiring even greater scrutiny and oversight in especially on the resource planning side. But at the same time, we appreciate the federal government's interest in what we're doing, and
Because this wasn't a quick, I mean, this started, you know, a year before I got on the commission. And so over the last, you know, couple of years, there's had comments back from the investor owns, from other folks that are interested about what they thought was the right thing to do. And, you know, we had a couple work sessions on it. But I truly believe that we're doing the right thing in our energy development. We're doing the way that suits us best, not a federal playbook to follow.
Yeah, it really is a matter of there are two approaches. One is that you do some of these things through rulemakings, and rulemakings by their nature apply to every utility equally. The other is that you deal with it on a case-by-case basis through rate cases, and the commission, and I certainly found that is the more appropriate way to do it. And the reason is because even in the upper Midwest, you have utilities whose profiles are very different. You've got XL, which has substantial nuclear plants. You've got MDU and Otter Tail, which tend to be more coal-based. They have different load profiles. They tend to have different customer class-type profiles. And when you're dealing with unique utility companies, it's really best to handle these energy efficiency programs and demand response programs on a case-by-case basis. They each have, you know, they're various sizes. A company like XL has an ability to perhaps leverage some resources to install certain types of equipment that a much smaller company like Otter Tail may or may not have. So it's they're very unique. It's very individual. We look favorably upon demand response and energy efficiency programs that pass the cost-benefit test, but they're best done individually with each company and not through a one-size-fits-all process.
You know, given our process in North Dakota, given the expertise that has been developed both by our staff and I think by the commission as well, I never can imagine why we would restrict ourselves by rule or by policy when we have the jurisdiction already to make decisions based on evidence and an individual record and testimony and expertise of people involved. So, again, while it provides some nice guidance and appreciate the federal government's interest in what we do, I think we do it quite well.
Yeah. One of the things that I think kind of developed, I'm not speaking for the gentleman next to me, but I think it is, that a pricing, a rates that encourage the customers to save money themselves is what we really liked in the workshops. It came out that as new technologies come online and the smart metering, the smart grids, where we can have the meters that will be able to price it immediately so the customer can then, you know, switch their behavior to save money, that's what we think is the best way to set that up. And that came out pretty clear in the work session. So, and I believe that the investor owns heard that from us, and as they can afford to put new things out there, that's where we're headed, is that a system where we can do almost instantaneous reading to get rates that encourage the customers to change their behavior, which levels out the power load. I think that's where we're headed, personally.
Sure. And just to kind of put a fine point on the how each of these companies is different, I mean, I mentioned XL and Otter Tail. Think about something like the smart grid. I'm glad that a company like XL, one of the top five largest utility companies in the country, is taking a lead through, for example, its Boulder project in developing smart grid, because it can deliver those kinds of benefits. I'd be very concerned if one of the smallest utility companies, investor-owned utility companies in the country, which Otter Tail is, if they were taking that same kind of risk, because it's very expensive and they don't have a lot of customers to spread those costs over. So that's why it's just better to handle, I think, these things individually.
Well, and, you know, and Brian's point about if we can put in place policies that incent the utilities to send as clear and as true price signals as possible to the consumer, the consumer will make the right decision based on their own personal economics, and we don't have to create some sort of a complicated tariff or a rate scheme to sort of contrive it. So I agree, and North Dakotans are pretty darn savvy. And then you take that to the next level, and you think about companies like NISC, who is doing exactly that for rural electric cooperatives all over the country, providing that sort of backbone expertise and technical expertise and software development, or companies like Steffes, who develop, create, and then produce energy storage units that can respond. Then where customers can respond to true price signals and store energy, if you will, and use it at other times of the day. There are just lots of good things happening that don't require rules.
I mean, just looking at the original purpose standards, are these even necessary to say that, well, you should really do this? I mean,
you should conserve energy, you should have optimal efficiency, you should have equitable rates. I mean, no one's out there saying, well, let's screw the customer over on rates, let's have unoptimal efficiency, and let's waste energy as much as possible. I mean, what is the point of this?
Well, I think you kind of hit what we concluded, that we looked through the paperwork that they asked us to consider it. We considered it. We figured that we're doing a pretty good job here in our state, and therefore we're not going to enact the federal. We're going to continue on case-by-case basis.
I suppose.
I mean, I guess the question becomes, do you think that you're accomplishing these factors by what you're doing presently? And that's
yes, I think so, and we do more. We do a better job. We're not limiting ourselves just to those seven things that they talked about. If
one of the things, and we've talked about this before, Dale, but one of the challenges that we have in North Dakota, I call it a challenge, but it's a good challenge to have, is that all of these programs, energy efficiency, demand response, demand side management, they have a cost to it. And you can calculate that cost on a kilowatt hour basis. Now, in a state like North Dakota that has the fourth lowest retail electric costs in the country, it can be tough to have demand response and energy efficiency programs that are cheaper than the cost of power itself. And we've traditionally taken a standard where we say that the cost-benefit analysis has to be that at the end of the day, the efficiency programs and the response programs have to cost less than the actual power itself, or else you're just raising costs for consumers for no good reason. If you're in a state that has, and some states do, 2 to 3 times the electric costs that we do, it gets pretty easy to be a champion of energy efficiency and demand response, because there are lots of energy efficiency programs and demand response programs and pricing programs that are cheaper than their actual retail cost of power. And so it makes all the sense in the world for them to be very aggressive with it. With us, there's just such a thin margin for error, and a thin margin that we're working with because our costs are so cheap relative to the rest of the country that it makes it more challenging for us to be really aggressive on some of these programs, because at the end of the day, you'd be raising unnecessarily costs for consumers.
And I suppose there are parts of this great country of ours where citizens aren't as well-informed and have as much common sense as North Dakotans do. They require a little more federal oversight.
I guess I when I was looking through that order, I was looking specifically at the smart grid aspect of it, and it seemed that what was being said was, well, Xcel says, well, we're doing it down here. MDU said, well, gee, you know, we like the concept of this, but could we please, like, kick the can down the road a little bit?
Well, I think you know what? At this point, that's probably a reasonable response, to be honest, because these smart grid projects are not free and they're not cheap. And utility commissioners across the country have this same discussion. We all see the potential benefit of it. We all see that there are lots of innovations that could come out. There are all kinds of applications you can put on. There are lots of companies that are out there just chomping at the bit to sell pieces of equipment and applications on this smart grid, but everybody wants somebody else to pay for it. And at the end of the day, it's utility commissions that stand between the folks who want everybody else to pay for it and the consumers who will have to pay for it through their electric bills. And someone's got to make judgment calls about cost and benefit. And as I said, it's difficult in North Dakota, where we have low-cost electric power, to sometimes make those decisions. And I think our utilities probably wisely, especially our smaller utilities, are saying, let's get a little bit of a track record within the industry first before we start sinking a lot of ratepayer money into these projects.
But you know, don't forget, you know, waste heat recovery. MDU's got this big plan over at Zeeland and one over at Glen Ellyn. I mean, we're doing a lot of these great things in the state that nobody seems to pick up on. I mean, MDU just had their ribbon cutting out there. There's a lot of things that are going on for ways to do energy efficiency, and that waste heat recovery at Zeeland and MDU, that or at Glen Ellyn, that comes to mind right away. That's what, 7 megawatts. Per day for both those plants.
When was PURPA acted? It was late 70s?
78, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was quite a different energy context than we're dealing with now.
Mm. Yes. Yeah.
Very good. How about them Vikings? Huh?
The Farves. Minnesota Farves.
Purple's the new green, baby. All right. I think we can close the meeting now. Huh?